Good morning, everyone. My name is Danny Kwa. I'm director of the Southeast Asia Center here. I don't have anything else to do but to open the proceedings in the sense of bringing up on stage His Excellency Pak Rizal Sukma, Indonesian Ambassador to the United Kingdom, since February this year. Previously, he had been Executive Director at one of the distinguished think tanks in Jakarta, the Center for Strategic and International Studies. His credentials as an intellectual, as a thinking relevant, policy relevant intellectual, are sealed, moreover, by the fact that he has an international relations PhD here at the LSE. So if you could join me in welcoming His Excellency up on stage to deliver his keynote lecture.
Thank you, Danny. Professor Poh, Professor Saw, and all distinguished excellencies. I have three my colleagues here, three ambassadors from Singapore, Laos, and Brunei. I think only three. I'm still not used to being called Excellency. Danny just called me Excellency. It still sounds a bit weird. You know, since I actually spend a lot of time here at the LSE, you know, especially with Jay in the room, it's very difficult actually to talk about Southeast Asia or ASEAN. By the way, Jay, titinan Bong Sudirak, actually we overlap a bit, but he worked with late Professor Susan Strange and then Professor Michael Leifer. I also work with Professor Michael Leifer here. And there are a few others, you know, actually, at that time that we worked together. And I think James, I see you, James. Where, James? I think James, you were early, a bit like 2 years, you know, before Jay and I came. And then after that, Ambassador Dino Jalal, the Indonesia's, a former Indonesia's Deputy Foreign Minister, also became a student of Professor Michael Leifer. It's actually, I've been waiting, you know, to be invited by LSE, you know, not only, you know, since I arrived, you know, in London as ambassador, but actually even after, you know, I finished my master's and PhD degrees here at the LSE. So one assume that, you know, I just assume that you don't need to be an ambassador to be invited, you know, to give a talk, because I've never been invited to deliver any talk at the LSE since I finished my study back in 1997, I believe, in January. It was a very cold day when I had to do my viva. Then there were four professors actually sitting and examines, you know, my dissertation. It was quite tough. But actually, it took them, I think, like less than a minute to decide whether they passed me or not. And fortunately, they did pass me without any revisions, that I think. So on that one, you know, I brought the draft. I brought the dissertation straight to Routledge, and it was published, you know, 2 years later. So it's actually, you know, the time that the Routledge need, you know, in order to publish a dissertation, is actually almost the same with the time that you need to complete that, you know, a dissertation or thesis. You know, we call it here thesis, you know, that we run from the Americans, because we are better here, I think, than the Americans. Again, because of this, I would like to thank Professor Danny Kwa, and also I believe that the in Indonesia we call it the intellectual actor is basically, you know, the puppet master, you know, who designed everything, which is actually, I believe, you know, Hürgen, you know, played, I think, a role, you know, in convincing Danny as well, you know, I think, to invite me to deliver this keynote speech. Let me begin by reminding some of you about an op-ed that I wrote, I think, 7 years ago in the Jakarta Post. The title was A Post-ASEAN Policy, ASEAN Foreign Policy for Indonesia. So if you remember, I'm sure that I think John Dorsch, you know, remember that, and also Jay would remember that, because the op-ed at that time, I think 2009, created a lot of anger, you know, especially within the Indonesia's foreign ministry, and also, you know, among some of our friends in the regions. I know that, you know, some actually researchers, especially at the Rajaratnam School at the time, was instructed, you know, to rebut, you know, whatever arguments that I tried to advance through that. A very, I think, short op-ed, 600 words, that I wrote. So I remembered, Barry Desker, Ambassador, he wrote also a piece. And then I think Ambassador Tommy Koh was also very upset, at that article. And they all believed that, Indonesia was about to exit ASEAN at the time. So we were actually earlier, compared to the UK on this debate about regional membership. But today, I think it's a bit difficult for me because I can't decide, should I talk as an ambassador or should I talk as a former executive director of CSIS, or especially the graduate, of the LSE. So I try to combine both. There are some, I think it's more my personal views, which might become also the official policy later on. But some, probably also what, we in Indonesia think about, Indonesia and ASEAN. And today, I would risk the same reaction, from my ASEAN friends by choosing more or less a similar title. But I will put the question mark. So the title of the lecture today is actually a post-ASEAN regional order, in East Asia. So I try to, actually extend the questions that we pose back home, whether Indonesia needs a post-ASEAN foreign policy. But now the question is really, are we seeing the beginning of, a post-ASEAN regional order, in East Asia? Why I chose this title? But of course, we all know Professor Michael Leifer, has spent, I think, more than 40 years of his career thinking about, regional order, thinking about, how state, actually shaped and also be shaped, by the regional order. So I think regional order project, has always been the most important, I think, hallmark, of LSE's English schools thinking over the last even 40, 50 years. So this tradition, I believe, has been carried on by Jürgen over there. So he wrote a book, Regional Order. Jay also, I think we had a lot of debate, on what sort of regional order that we need, in East Asia. So I think LSE and Professor Michael Leifer, had played a very important role in shaping many of us in the regions, our thinking in the regions on how we think about and how we are going to shape the regional order in the regions. So, but, I do believe that my colleagues, ambassadors from ASEAN will credit me for putting that questions mark. So it's not really a statement, but it's basically a question whether we are going to see a post-ASEAN regional order in the regions. And that questions mark, I believe, clearly suggests, the uncertain nature, of the emerging regional order, in East Asia. We know the world's geoeconomic and geopolitical center of gravity is shifting to East Asia. We already know China is fast becoming a great power, if not already is. We also know that the U.S., the United States, is trying to sustain the primacy in the world. Yet, strategic change that we are seeing at the moment is still unraveling and still actually taking place. And then the final outcome, of that strategic change, I think, remains to be seen. So we can't actually know for sure, what final outcomes of that strategic change that we will, we'll see. However, there are two developments that have emerged, from that change so far, which I believe, begin to define, our regions. First, a great power game is returning to Southeast Asia. Some of you might not like this reality, but, I think this is the reality that we must face. Then I will dwell on this, development later on. And second, the future of Southeast Asia is increasingly defined by how extra-regional powers interact with each other. So the key questions, again, before us is actually, are we about to see the end of the ASEAN-centered regional order? For those of you who are not familiar with this, studies on regional order or regional architecture, as some, scholars, actually call it, there are at least, three elements of the regional order that we have in East Asia. The first one is really regional order based on, the U.S. centrality. It's basically, the hub and spoke and the U.S., military alliance, system. That is, I think, the first element of the regional order. Second one is ASEAN-centered processes. This is the multilateral processes that, ASEAN, had initiated since 1975, especially especially since the end of the Cold War in 1992 with the establishment of the RAF, you know, and so on. And then the third element of regional order is the key bilateral relationships, you know, among the regional states, you know, themselves, because we do believe that bilateral relationships are also important. So ASEAN-centered processes or ASEAN-centered or ASEAN-led institution is an important part of that, you know, regional order that I'm talking about. So let me go on and try to look at all these aspects of regional order and then try to build an argument why I may be worried that we are seeing the end of the ASEAN-centered regional order here. Indonesia has been and will continue to be, you know, a strong proponent of ASEAN. So I think that's a policy statement, so it's not an academic statement, because it is true. You know, even though, you know, we did show some degree of frustrations in the past with how the ASEAN evolved, you know, we did show also even anger, you know, and also at times, you know, pessimism, you know, on how ASEAN actually evolved. But at the end, we will always, you know, I think, be loyal, you know, to ASEAN. So in fact, for almost five decades now, Indonesia has been loyal and will continue to be committed, you know, to the ASEAN, you know, goals. So it is precisely for this reason why, you know, I believe that we in the regions need to examine again and again the strategic challenges that facing ASEAN, you know, at the moment. So I don't think that we can address the challenges that we face now by issuing more and more declarations, joint communique, or chairman statement. So we have, I think, you know, I've seen those, you know, I think from the bottom, you know, so this much, all those joint communique, those, Jay is laughing, actually. This is a lot, you know, so you go to internet, you print them out, you know, I think like 2 meters, you know, high, if you put, you know, on the floor. So here, you know, I would like to discuss, you know, a focus on three issues. First, I will discuss very briefly challenges brought about by the power transitions in East Asia. And second, I will also examine the type of regional order that ASEAN wants to build and the problems confronting ASEAN's efforts in bringing that order, you know, into reality. And then finally, I will discuss Indonesia's positions and response to the questions of regional order building in East Asia. But because of the time constraint, because I know it's 15 minutes, actually, it's quite, you know, short if you are asked to deliver a lecture. But if you ask to make a political statement, it's actually too long. So I will limit on three strategic aspects of the ongoing, you know, power shift that would have serious implications, you know, for ASEAN. First, the rise of China. Second, the U.S. response. And then third, the Sino-U.S., you know, rivalry. So these are, I think, the three big elephants that, you know, many of us try to not to talk about, especially when it comes to the questions whether the lesser powers need to choose, you know, when the major powers or great powers actually begin to compete. So first, I don't need to talk about, you know, at length, you know, on the rise of China, but we all agree, I think, that China, you know, is a driving force, you know, behind the ongoing power shift, you know, in East Asia. So over the last two decades, you know, China has consistently demonstrated its ability, you know, to sustain economic growth, you know, at an impressive rate. True that they now have a problem, but I think it's not going to change the trajectory that they are actually following, especially, you know, in the process of becoming a great power. And China's military capability has also improved significantly, even though it is still below the U.S. capability at the moment. Indeed, you know, China's rapid rise, you know, as an economic powerhouse and military power has reinforced the country's centrality in regional and global politics. So it is clear that China would soon meet its strategic aspirations of becoming a daguo, a great power. So I think it's just within reach, you know, that China will soon become a daguo. And China has now become a nation with a very strong sense of confidence and assertive nationalism. And as its power continues to accumulate, it is to be expected that China would want greater recognition and more respect from others. Second, the U.S. remains the most powerful state, you know, in East Asia, no doubt. And however, its influence in the region has increasingly been limited by the rise of China. So it is clear that the U.S. feels the necessity to maintain and ensure, you know, its political primacy, economic interest, and military preponderance, you know, in the regions. So it has declared renewed commitment and interest to sustain that status, you know, in the Asia-Pacific, you know, especially in East Asia. So this intention, of course, you know, has been well reflected, you know, in President Obama's policy of rebalancing and also the drive, you know, to strengthen the security and defense relationship with its allies and partners, you know, especially Australia, Japan, the Philippines, Singapore, and also, you know, with Vietnam. So that is actually also shows, you know, the commitment of the U.S. to match, you know, the declaration of intents, you know, and, you know, actions. Economically also, you know, I think the U.S., you know, has seen the TPP as a very important, you know, instrument for them to actually implement the rebalancing strategy. So the third, you know, as China's rise become inevitable and the U.S. feels obliged to pursue a rebalancing strategy, so I think it is far from certain how Sino-U.S. relationship is going to evolve, you know, in the future. So while no one in the regions want to see a strategic rivalry between the two great powers, recent developments suggest that might be the case already. So in my view, a China-U.S. rivalry is no longer a possibility, but an emerging reality. So as a rising power with its own interests, China seems to see the U.S., you know, as the only power that might limit its regional preeminence. So meanwhile, the U.S. is clearly opposed to the rise of a new power that might pose a challenge to its preeminence, you know, in the regions. So at the same time, strategic rivalry, you know, between the U.S. and China over maritime access, supremacy, and dominance, you know, in the two strategic oceans, the Indian Oceans and the South China Sea or the Pacific Asians, oceans, is also of particular concern, you know, for all of us in Southeast Asia. So rich in natural resources and crucial for sea lanes of communications, so these two oceans are of significant strategic value for fundamental national interests, not only of major powers, but also for the entire regions and beyond. And I see in the program that I think Bill Hatton will talk about, you know, South China Sea later. So, you know, we'll skip that, a very delicate and very difficult question, but you can ask me questions later on that one. So this actually three strategic development, you know, the rise of China, the U.S. attempt to retain its primacy and the implications of both, you know, for China-U.S. relations, so bring about three strategic implications for ASEAN, which in turn could undermine Southeast Asia's regional autonomy or Southeast Asia's strategic autonomy. The first impact, a Sino-U.S. strategic rivalry, especially if it becomes more intense, has the potential to polarize ASEAN. We don't talk about this, you know, very often, because we believe, or at least we'd like to believe, that will never happen. Second, if ASEAN becomes polarized due to the growing rivalry between the U.S. and China, ASEAN's role as a manager of regional order, I borrowed this, you know, phrase from late Professor Michael Leifer, you know, ASEAN as manager of regional order, would become marginalized. So ASEAN rooms for maneuver would be severely constrained by strategic choices met by the competing extra-regional great powers. The third implication, as ASEAN become polarized and marginalized, the applications of ASEAN centrality would become more difficult to sustain. Indeed, you know, if this scenario becomes a reality, ASEAN would find itself in a very, very difficult, you know, position. So in this context, you know, ASEAN's greatest nightmare, you know, is to be in a position where its member states would have to abandon regional unity. And in the pursuit of national security, it would be forced to take side in the emerging China-U.S. rivalry. That would mean the end of the ASEAN-centered regional order, not the end of this lecture. ASEAN ability, I think, you know, to manage those three challenges will, you know, I think depend on the type of regional order that would emerge in the regions. So while analysts and scholars differ, you know, regarding the extent of the ASEAN role and influence in shaping that regional order, so I think it's quite safe to say that ASEAN does agree that any regional order need to serve at least five strategic elements, five strategic purpose. Number one, any regional order that emerged in Southeast Asia must be able to preserve ASEAN centrality. So this is, I think, you know, the concept of ASEAN strategic autonomy that all ASEAN members, I think, agree on. Second, we also realize that order must be able to accommodate major powers' role, you know, in the regions. So because we look at the history of Southeast Asia, you know, after Zofan, after 1975, we believe that Southeast Asia security could be guaranteed if we keep major powers out. But, you know, see, after the end of the Cold War, we also realized that you can't do that. You know, so you can keep Southeast Asia's stability if, you know, actually you bring all the major powers. So that's, you know, the East Asia Summit and other arrangements actually was based on the thinking that, you know, it's better to have these major powers together, you know, in Southeast Asia rather than, you know, to have them outside and then they try to actually intervene in the internal developments of Southeast Asia. The third objective of regional power, regional order that all ASEAN countries want to see is actually to prevent both strategic rivalry among the major powers, and also we want to prevent a concept of powers, you know, among them. Number four, regional order need to ensure, you know, ASEAN access, you know, to material benefits, either defense, trade, investment, financial cooperation, market access, you know, and so on. And then finally, it must facilitate regional integrations process, you know, especially in the ASEAN community building. So since the beginning of the 21st century, you know, we all, you know, actually have been trying to do all this, you know, especially with the agreement in 2003, you know, to transform in, ASEAN into the ASEAN community. So I think, you know, we have been trying, you know, very, very hard, you know, in order to shape, you know, this the emerging regional order, you know, in the regions, you know, since 2003. However, many saw, you know, that ASEAN efforts as inadequate, you know, as those efforts, you know, hampered by the internal differences, you know, within ASEAN itself, you know, from different levels of economic development, diversity in the political system, internal stability, and also diverging strategic, you know, orientations, you know, among the ASEAN member state. So in short, there is a degree of skepticism among its extra-regional partners regarding the relevance and also the ability of ASEAN to serve as an effective manager of regional order. And I think if you look at the program, the title of John Dorsch's presentation reflect that, you know, skepticism, you know. So it's like only sideshow, according to him. So I hope you challenge him later on. But I will stay also to challenge you, John. So ASEAN tried to address the criticism by taking an initiative that would open up the possibility for a more inclusive and more promising regional order, you know, to emerge. While its initiative is still anchored, you know, within the tradition of ASEAN centrality and ASEAN-led process, so it also registers a greater willingness on the part of ASEAN to recognize the role of extra-regional powers in setting the agenda of regional conversations at high-level forums such as the EAS. So a more institutionalized EAS, the East Asia Summit, in my view, provides an opportunity, you know, for ASEAN not only to reinforce its diplomatic relevance, but also to shape a regional order through which it could seek to achieve the five-man strategy objective that I mentioned, you know, earlier. So I do believe that, you know, if we want ASEAN to be relevant and will continue, you know, to play, you know, this important role in the regions, then we need to institutionalize the East Asia Summit, you know, because I think this is the only institutions where all great powers, major powers, medium powers, small powers, whatever you call it, it actually has a seat around the table. But, you know, one should also recognize, you know, a preference of ASEAN, you know, for a certain type of regional order, while necessary, is not sufficient, you know, to ensure peace and stability in the regions. So we do believe that, you know, norms, you know, and also institutions are important. You know, it can shape, you know, state behavior. But personally, you know, being a student of Michael Leifer and the LSE, I don't believe it's enough. So actually, you know, because of the nature, you know, of the grouping, you know, of ASEAN as a group of, you know, lesser powers, so I don't think that ASEAN can act independently of major powers. So ASEAN cannot act, you know, independently of major powers. So in this context, you know, it can be argued that any regional order in Southeast Asia will also require a stable balance of power among major powers. So all those institutions and normative arrangement will not work unless we do have a stable balance of power among the great powers in the regions. So ASEAN-driven multilateral processes, therefore, would not function well without some sort of balance in the relationships among the major powers. But at the same time, ASEAN is not in the position to create such a balance. So you see this predicament, you know, that ASEAN face. And I think other countries as well, such even Australia, South Korea, also face the same predicament, you know, when it comes, when it comes to the questions of how we deal with the emerging, you know, rivalry among the U.S., between the U.S. and China. So how does Indonesia respond, you know, to that changing strategic environment, you know, in East Asia? Indonesia needs to have good relationship, you know, with both the U.S. and China. We all do. I don't think you know, any country say that we don't need, you know, good relationship with both, you know, countries. I recognize that Indonesia, like many other countries, will also face the same predicament, you know, in the growing rivalry between China and the U.S. One thing is clear, Indonesia does not wish the regions to be dominated by one power or a group of powers. And I think we all, you know, share that interest in Southeast Asia. Indonesia is not interested in sustaining Pax Americana. We are also not interested in helping the emergence of Pax Sinica. We are also aware of the impossibility of Pax Asiana can be done, let alone a Pax Indonesiana, even though we love to have that one. So what we are all interested in is actually only to preserve Southeast Asia's strategic autonomy. So we don't want to go back to the 1970s where the major powers actually, you know, fought each other, competed with each other, you know, at the expense of all Southeast Asian countries. So what are the choices available, you know, to us? First, I do think that we need to continue to work within the three types of the overlapping regional orders in East Asia. So there are three types of regional orders existing in East Asia. The first is the realist order. So I think within this order, we all agree that, you know, Indonesia seeks to strengthen, you know, its strategic partnership with all the major powers and medium powers. There is still very strong this balance of power elements, you know, in Southeast Asia. And I believe that this realist, you know, order, you know, is a bit dominant, even though, you know, we try actually to make it softer, you know, through by creating the second type of regional order in the region, which I call a normative order. So this is basically the ASEAN-based order, and Indonesia will continue to work with ASEAN partners to invoke, you know, ASEAN norms and ASEAN diplomatic centrality. So you have a realist-based order where all powers, balance of powers, role of great powers, but there is also the normative, you know, order, and I think that is also important, you know, because we also believe that institutions and norms do influence, you know, state behavior. And finally, there is what I call as the institution-based order, and then here, you know, the East Asia Summit, you know, has the potential to incorporate, you know, both the first and the second types of order. And I think Indonesia has been advocating advocate that East Asia Summit need to be strengthened. So that's, I think, you know, the first choice that we have, you know, to deal with that strategic, you know, changes. Second, Indonesia has positioned itself, you know, as a global maritime fulcrum, a power, you know, between two strategic oceans. So as a maritime or archipelagic state, we will secure our maritime interests by integrating the two strategic seas, the Indian Oceans and the Pacific Oceans, as the focus of our foreign policy. So I'm talking about as ambassador now. We are aware of the growing importance, you know, of the maritime domain, you know, for future prosperity and stability of the regions. So unfortunately, the rivalry among the major powers will take place in the maritime domain, so in the area of Pacific and Indian Oceans, or the PASINDO region, as I call it. And unfortunately also, so maritime domain in East Asia, you know, is still characterized by a number of unresolved territorial disputes and the growing competitions of access to maritime-based resources. And I think Indonesia will continue to work with our neighbors to resolve both maritime and land boundaries. We will defend our maritime sovereignty and sovereign rights, protect our marine resources, and also ensure the security and the safety of our seas. So I think we will continue to play an active role in finding solutions to the South China Sea dispute. So the title of Bill Hatton paper later on, actually I think on something is called like, you know, ASEAN and South China Sea is only good on paper. So I think my criticism of that, you know, title actually is not even yet on the paper. So how can you say that it's only good, you know, on the paper? Anyway, so we will do all this, you know, I think through the application of the UNCLOS, because we believe UNCLOS is the only legitimate source that you can regulate governance and govern the interstate relation when it comes to the sea. And also we will do that, you know, through the maritime diplomacy, naval enhancement, and also regional maritime cooperation. So in conclusion, let me reiterate the following, you know, points. East Asia is changing, and that change presents ASEAN with a delicate strategic predicament. How to preserve ASEAN's strategic autonomy in the face of growing rivalry among extra-regional powers is, I think, is a very, very difficult challenge, you know, to face in the years to come. It's not enough to say that we don't want to choose. We want to be friends to both. So there will be a time when you will be put in the position to choose. So whether you will choose rightly or not, that's entirely up to the ability of those, you know, at the top hierarchies of powers, you know, in each member state, you know, to respond to those, you know, challenges. And failure to address the strategic predicament would bring an end to the ASEAN-centered regional order in East Asia. It would also mean the full return of power politics, you know, to East Asia. And the return of power politics needs to be prevented. We also need to prevent the emergence of great power concepts, you know, in the regions. To this end, ASEAN has no choice but to strengthen its capacity, boost its credibility, and consolidate its unity. So I think only then ASEAN centrality, this is the latest mantra of ASEAN, we're good in making mantra, only then ASEAN centrality will be taken seriously by other powers in the regions. The question is really, can we, you know, strengthen the capacity? Can we improve the credibility? And then can we actually strengthen the unity among the ASEAN, you know, countries? So that's actually require really, really, you know, close cooperation and close consultation among the ASEAN member states. So I think I just stop there. Thank you so much.
His Excellency has been kind enough to agree to a short Q&A session. So the understanding is that this is all obviously off the record.
On the record is also fine.
On the record is also fine. But I will leave it to people's discretion. While you're ready in your questions, perhaps I could invoke chair prerogative and ask you, Your Excellency. You've mentioned how TPP is part of the United States' bulwark of activities in the region. I'm worrying if we rely too much on the TPP-driven narrative. For one thing, it strikes me that neither Presidents Trump nor Clinton is particularly, shall we say, friendly to a full-on sympathetic engagement with this part of the world. Add to that the huge uncertainty associated with whether TPP will actually pass U.S. Congress, either in the lame duck session or afterwards in the new presidency. Of course, weighed against that is already a Chinese-driven narrative on One Belt, One Road. It can't pass without notice that it was actually in Jakarta in 2013 that President Xi Jinping announced the Maritime Silk Road part of One Belt, One Road. And whatever we might think about their intentions, certainly the record of implementing projects is one that shows a great deal of success. They still have the financial resources. They're willing to put up to $1 trillion of resources into the One Belt, One Road project generally, with the possibility that it might increase trade throughout the 40 nation states by as much as $2.5 trillion. Now, that seems to me a lot more concrete than, for now, the TPP-driven narrative. How does ASEAN see its location relative to these two large narratives, TPP and One Belt, One Road?
can't speak for the whole, you know, ASEAN member state. But let me put it this way. In the regions, we believe that, you know, we can actually have, you know, a lot of arrangements at the same time. But of course, it's actually the way we look at it, it's not so much between TPP and the OBOR project, you know, the One Belt, One Road project, but it's actually how you, you know, push synergies between TPP on the one hand and then the FTEP on the other, plus, of course, the ASEAN-led RCEP. This is the one that, you know, I think not many people even in ASEAN talk about at the moment. I agree with you that it's not easy even for the US and for the, all those members of the TPP. We're not, Indonesia is not yet part of the TPP, you know, to pass, you know, and get the ratification by some congresses or parliaments, you know, in their countries. Especially, we look at the changes in the views, you know, of Hillary Clinton. Even if she wins, you know, I think she will also has a problem, you know, in passing that legislation. So that's why I think over the last 6 months or so, there is now an attempt to renew the commitment and also to push for these discussions within the RCEP, the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, between ASEAN and also the other major powers, you know, in that context. So it will take a lot of time before, you know, we can say whether the TPP is going to be a reality that, you know, we all need to face. But, you know, for Indonesia, this debate has been quite good, you know, because it's actually, you know, it has the domestic implication as well with regard to what extent that you need to actually reform your economy, you know, in order to face, you know, those, you know, challenges, you know, because, you know, when Vietnam decided, you know, to be part of the TPP, you know, of course, you know, it triggered a lot of debate in Indonesia, you know, with regard to the competitiveness of Indonesian products, and, you know, especially in the footwear, textile, and so on, you know, if that TPP can, I think, you know, be passed, you know, by, you know, by, you know, by the. Coming back to the questions of this OBOR, you know, the One Belt, One Road, you know, or the Maritime Silk Road, if you like, it's true that, you know, China has resources, you know, to implement that, and also, of course, the willingness is there. But, you know, I think for us, you know, as long as that project is about diplomacy and economy and not about hegemony, I think we can work with it.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Yes, please, ma'am. The microphone is coming around. If you could, if it's on the record, it's up to you whether you want to identify yourself quickly or not. Yeah. Up to you.
Thank you so much, and very informative and awakening for many. And my name is Kim Amati, and I'm from Burma and also a great scholar. And as you can see here, there's a Burma is still minority, and not people from the embassy not here yet. Mm. But my question to you is that, now, as you know, the opposition leader has become state councillor and foreign ambassador. And she has been criticizing ASEAN along the way for many years. So how much her role will make a difference to ASEAN? And what are the ASEAN approach to Burma? Thank you.
Excellent. That's not provocative.
I don't think that a country's, you know, foreign policy is really determined by one person. It's not even, you know, during, say, when Indonesia was led by one man, actually, you know, for 32 years. You know, so because, you know, it will always be, you know, the process of works for many, many, you know, people in that particular country. And also, everybody actually also takes into consideration, you know, of the regional processes and also external you know, influences. So when you look at where Myanmar now in its relationship with ASEAN, it actually started a long time ago. So I think I can't actually see how that, you know, can be changed. You know, I don't think that you're not thinking that Myanmar, you know, will quit ASEAN, right? So I don't think that, you know, it's possible. As no one in Southeast Asia, you know, think that, you know, we will quit, you know, ASEAN. You're not thinking that, like, Thailand should quit. You know? So, you know, in that context, you know, I think the process of integration of Myanmar, you know, into ASEAN, you know, has been well, you know, profit, you know, especially when Myanmar was the chair, you know, of ASEAN. I went there, I was there, you know, so we were actually quite impressed at how, you know, the level of commitment of many people at the foreign ministries in Naypyidaw, you know, in order to, you know, make, you know, this ASEAN cooperation quite success. And in fact, with the opening up of the economy as well, if you also look around and learn from the experience of other ASEAN countries, you know, ASEAN really helped you know, in bringing all those, you know, capitals and investment that, you know, Myanmar, you know, need at the moment. So in that context, you know, I think we just hope that the progress that Myanmar is heading toward now will continue to be you know, the same. But of course, there will always be some problems, you know, with some, you know, ASEAN countries, you know, with regard to some developments in Myanmar as well. You know, for us, to be frank, you know, we all want to continue our discussion and engagement with the government in Naypyidaw regarding, you know, the Rohingya, if you like. So that's been, you know, I think, you know, a concern of many Muslim groups in the country. But of course, you know, we address this kind of problem, you know, in a very so-called, you know, ASEAN way. So that's, you know, I think will continue, you know, to be a main characteristic of how our engagement with Myanmar will be.
Excellent. Other questions? Sir? The recording works better if you've got that.
Okay. My name is Frederick Lim. I'm a PhD candidate, and I'm writing on ASEAN. You said that everything Indonesia does in the South China Sea, they will take UNCLOS as the basis. Did I understand you correctly? What good is UNCLOS, though, if the major source of the dispute, or the, let's call it the problems, does not recognize the application of UNCLOS to the South China Sea? And my second question is, if I may, at what point will Indonesia stop claiming it was not a party to the South China Sea dispute? And will the encroachment of China on the Natuna Islands actually turn out a blessing for ASEAN because Indonesia will position itself?
Excellent. Two questions.
Even the U.S., even if the U.S. does not, you know, recognize UNCLOS, you know, I think if you look at, you know, the practices of the U.S., it's actually quite consistent as well, you know, with all these, you know, terms within UNCLOS. So I think when you become a great, you know, maritime power, you will regret you sign up to UNCLOS. But I think that's quite, you know, normal because you don't want to be, you know, constrained. So in that context, I think all the countries, you know, who are directly involved, you know, in East Asia, you know, I think, you know, we continue to see the importance of UNCLOS. Because if not of UNCLOS, then you don't have any, you know, basis whatsoever, you know, in order to, you know, resolve, you know, the problem. You don't have any basis whatsoever in regulate the interstate relations when it comes to the maritime domain. So, yes, UNCLOS is not perfect, you know, it's not clear on certain, you know, areas, but this is what we got, so that we need to stick to that. And in fact, we need to work to reinforce that, you know, to make it even stronger, you know, as the only regimes that regulate, you know, how you actually govern and also regulate the interstate relation when it comes to the maritime, you know, maritime domain. So, there are a lot of, I think, disputes in the past has been resolved, you know, because of, you know, these applications of UNCLOS. There are a lot of differences that have been resolved, you know, by resorting, you know, to UNCLOS as well in, you know, in the past. So UNCLOS is not, I think, it's not fair also to judge the process of the South China Sea resolutions, you know, by, you know, just UNCLOS only, you know, whether, you know, it can resolve, you know, of the South China Sea dispute. Because, you know, if you look at the dimensions of the South China Sea, you know, some aspect of it cannot be, you know, at least UNCLOS is still, you know, it's not really clear, you know, on certain aspect of that. So Indonesia is not, you know, party to conflict. It's a very simple, you know, for us, the nine dotted line is an imaginary line. It doesn't exist. If that line doesn't exist, how can you say that we have overlapping, you know, areas, you know, in our EEZ? So it has no legal basis whatsoever. You know, our government has made that statement very clearly many times. You know, so it does not exist. If it does not exist, how can you say it overlap with our, you know, EEZ? As simple as that. So that's why we keep saying that we are not part of the conflict. So what, you know, we saw a couple of weeks ago with that incident, you know, the fishing incident, we treat it simply as a problem of the IUU. You know, the illegal, unregulated fishing problems. You know, so, you know, we need, because, you know, that happened within our EEZ. So it does not violate our sovereignty, it does violate our sovereign rights, you know, within that, you know, EEZ. So we have to be very clear on that. So we treat it, you know, as such. So it's a fishing problem, so illegal fishing problem. But of course, you know, we also seek clarifications from China when they say that, you know, they do have I mean, they do see that area as their traditional fishing ground. Of the record, this one of record, I would like also to say, you know, that probably one day we will call Hainan as our favorite fishing ground. Then we will have a problem, right? So that's why we need to resort to all the legal terms provided for by, you know, UNCLOS. If you can claim, you know, one area as your traditional fishing ground, then I can claim also, you know, Darwin as our favorite, you know, fishing ground. So that, you see the problem if we begin to deviate from the, you know, international law. So that's why, you know, for us, you know, this is an illegal fishing problem. So of course we call China also to work with us, you know, in order to address this problem. So it's not about territorial disputes.
Thank you, Your Excellency. Extremely clear and unambiguous answer. Mustafa. Oh, and then Mustafa and then Jay. So.
Mustafa, I'm going to present later as well in the next panel. It's just a very fundamental question. Who makes foreign policy in Indonesia? Very, very fundamental. The reason I say that is that the fishing incident that you mentioned, there were a number of responses to that coming from different ministries that suggest a lack of coordination, and we don't really know who makes foreign policy in Indonesia. Maybe you can shed some light on that.
Thank you. Because I need to close the session, I'd like to take Jay's question as well on this round.
Okay, Excellency. Excellent speech. I want to draw attention to the linkage or the connection between the domestic politics and the regionalism. There have been some domestic political changes in the Philippines, the latest, certainly Thailand, Myanmar, new leadership in Laos and Vietnam, and Indonesia seems to be surging ahead. So, you know, this is a region now, is a testing ground for the future of democracies and autocracies and dictatorships. And this has impinged on regionalism. So you can imagine in a room when Aung San Suu Kyi goes to his meetings later this year with Duterte and you know, General Bayut, in the old days, in the previous generation, they had some esprit de corps, they had continuity, they had some camaraderie, and the leadership of individual leaders was instrumental in propelling ASEAN forward in the 70s, 80s, even the 90s. But now you see, I don't know what they will say to each other in the room. What do you think about that?
Thank you very much, Jay. Your Excellency.
I hope you're not writing a dissertation on, you know, it's just foreign policy. Yeah? So I think, you know, we can discuss that because it's quite, you know, long and complex answer. So I will not, you know, but again, you know, of course, you know, in any democracy, you know, policy will be decided after, you know, all these processes and debate, you know, actually completed. But of course, some, you know, we thought, you know, complete informations, but that's the process that, you know, we have to go through. And that's the process that we in Indonesia, you know, has been, I think, you know, taking since, you know, we become a democracy back in 1998. Now, so of course, you have the president, you have the military, also you have the foreign ministry, defense ministry, think tanks, and so on. They all actually, I think, also make foreign policy not much different compared to the study that, you know, I mean, time when the study written by, I can't remember this American guy who's now the vice president of the Asia, Gordon Hyde, you know, in 1982 or 1985, he wrote a very good dissertation on who make foreign policy in Indonesia. So I think the players are more the same, more or less the same. That's why I said, Jay, at the beginning, you know, I think foreign policy should not be left, you know, to the head of state, should not be left to the head of government only. Otherwise, we will have a problem, you know, because in democracies, you know, it changes every 5 years. Some even change it every year, like in 1998 to 2001, remember, 1998 to 2004, we changed, you know, head of state 4 times within, like, you know, 5 years. So that's why it's important, again, for ASEAN countries to strengthen the second track, because, you know, from my experience, that second track now is quite, you know, weak, because everybody pay more attention to domestic politics. So remember, in the past, something happened, you know, so I can call Jay, and then it went straight, you know, to some of the people in the foreign ministry, so, and also, with, you know, in Singapore, of course, we were very closely using all those, you know, those, it really helped, you know, because these are the institutions that, I think, keep, you know, the traditions and also, you know, the practices, you know, alive. Because, you know, if you rely on, you know, only a head of state and then a law, the personal preference, you know, of head of state, then you know, I think this ASEAN-ness, you know, might go away one day. You know, because some of these head of state probably no previous experience whatsoever with regionalism, with the ASEAN cooperation and so on. So that's why the relationship between foreign ministries, between the defense ministries, and also between the armed forces and among the academics and think tanks are crucial if you, you know, want to make sure that the spirit of ASEAN cooperation will continue, you know, to define, you know, how regionalism, you know, to evolve in the future.
Thank you. Now, normally I'd have to close the session now, but I can't resist the representative from the Chinese embassy. It might have a slightly different view about the nine dash line. So perhaps I could get you to speak to this.
Thank you for the opportunity, Your Excellency. And I just want to, because LSE is very famous for its third way in the past, and people talk so much about it, and the whole background for your talk today is that the coming maybe strategic rivalry between China and the United States, and what will be the response from the ASEAN side. But I just want to know, do you think that China and the United States will have a coming rivalry? Is it inevitable, or is that the background for your whole talks? Is it just a zero-sum game? Because in China, we have been talking about this new strategic major partnership between the United States and China. And in this connection, I also wish to ask maybe for Mr. Trump and Hillary, because they are coming to power in just maybe a few months' time. How would you see will be looking at next year, maybe at this time, will they, the United States, still pursue its policy of rebalancing, or will it change it? And how will the China-US relations go? And in that extent, how would you respond? And for the South China Sea, of course, our position are quite well known, and we will leave some more time for the next session.
Thank you very much. We'll need a lot of time after the session. But on the U.S.-China zero-sum game, win-win kind of...
Yeah, it's more difficult, you know, than even, you know, on the competition, because if you get the U.S.-China relationship at the moment, it has both cooperative and competitive elements. So that's what makes it very difficult. If they want to compete, easy for us, you know. If they want to cooperate, we know what they're doing, basically, then easy also for us to make a choice. But when the two elements, you know, actually also present, cooperative and competitive at the same time, it's a very hard. So this is something new. I'm not sure. Yeah. No, I've been trying to read all Hadley, Bulls, Martin White, you know, Butterfly, tried to look at whether there was a parallel in history. I cannot find it one. When, you know, the great powers actually conduct the, you know, relationship which involved both cooperative and competitive elements of relationships. Never happened in history before. Now, you look at the concept of Europe, you know, even before that, you know, all these competitions among the great European powers, they all competed. You know, so small countries, you know, they just use either bandwagoning or balancing or become a power, right? But when, you know, you have these great powers compete and cooperate at the same time, then you basically, you know, you're almost dead, you know, because you don't know when to cooperate, when to compete, when to move to the U.S., when to move to China. So this is, you know, something that, you know, we all, you know, to think about. You know, I think, you know, I hope LSE has a special course for that. You know, how you register, you know, how you deal with that such, you know, structure of, you know, great powers relationships.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Now, okay, we're going to switch over to the next session now. If everyone could just remain seated, but while we're in the process of switching to the next session, if you could all join me in thanking His Excellency for a wonderful morning.